The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly Premier League Windy Winter Break Special. Sheffield United climb to fifth with a win over Bournemouth. Can they get into the Champions League? Meanwhile, Everton move into prime position to win the Everton Cup with a win over Palace. And Jordan Pickford says that everybody hates him. West Brom move 4 points clear at the top of the Championship as Leeds lose again. It is very tight at the top of that division. Archie Rintut returns to talk us through the top two in Germany, drawing a blank. While in Serie A, there's another change at the top and there's an absolutely belting own goal in France. All that, plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Philippe Auclair.
Bonjour.
Bonjour, ça va?
Ça va?
In the WhatsApp group ahead of the pod, we were doing our French written practice, weren't we? Mm-hmm. Who would you say was better out of Lars Sivertsen and Barry, who are also here? Who was the best at French?
I think that I would just give the win to Lars Sivertsen.
Okay.
Yeah. Le singe est sur la branche was very good. Mm-hmm. Because Barry thought that songe meant monkey, it means dream. So, which is quite surreal.
Yes, Barry said the dream is in the tree.
Yeah.
Maybe it is.
Maybe. And I tried to say Barry's dreams are in the terrifying pub in Brixton, but that was a difficult sentence.
I said there's one word in that sentence. I still don't know what you mean.
Is terrifié, I went for.
Terrifié.
Does that mean terrifying?
It's a bit like coffee.
Okay. Well, if it doesn't mean terrifying in French, it absolutely should. Lars Sivertsen, officially nice to see you.
Hi, Max. Officially nice to see you too.
How are you?
I'm good.
Okay. Anything happened to you on the way to the office?
I feel like I made a mistake telling you. I had a fall. I fell down.
And you landed?
I went because it's a slightly delayed pod today. Mm. As we were told after I'd gotten up and all that we don't have to come in until a bit later than planned. So I thought, let's hang off. I'll just go to Subway, get a sub. Mm. It's not great food, but it does. It's mm-hmm. not that unhealthy. I got the turkey breast and turkey ham one.
Right.
Slightly fewer calories.
Okay.
And then on my way to the train, I fell over and landed on top of my sub.
Does that mean you're completely uninjured? Because
it's a pretty big one. Yeah, it's good.
Did you have the half a sub or the full?
I had the full one.
The full length.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I might not eat again today.
You landed on the subway.
Yeah,
did you just bounce back up again?
Pretty much. Yeah.
It's not so hearty Italian after Lars landed on it.
How are you, Barry?
Oh, grand, yeah, thanks.
Sheffield United 2, Bournemouth 1. They keep on going, Sheffield United. 2 points off fourth place, having played a game more. The chat still seems to be, Lars, will Spurs catch Chelsea? But is now the time we start seriously suggesting Sheffield United could get into the Champions League?
I'm out of the Sheffield United predicting game, having confidently picked them to go down at the beginning of the season. So whatever I say, I think, is totally invalid. But I think if you look at the league table, you have to at least take them seriously to an extent. And the fact that neither of the teams around them, Chelsea or Tottenham, look like they're going to be undefeated for the rest of the season, put it that way, that you have to say there is a bit of a window there. It's remarkable what they keep doing. And the way Chris Wilder is sort of getting extraordinary performances out of this team and these players. And I think it's quite heartening in the sense because, like a lot of people, I despair at the sort of increasing financial gap between the rich and the poor in football and how the sort of biggest global franchises are kind of pulling away and they're so much wealthier than everyone else. It is really good to see in Sheffield United that you can. There is this strange alchemy in football that if you get the right blend of people together under the right coach, you can still achieve stuff with players who you wouldn't think you could achieve stuff with.
You mentioned the money. Nick Harris at Sporting Intel tweeting, Sheffield United have the lowest wage bill in the Premier League this season. The average wage, I think it was in the Times, they said it was $700,000 a year, which is so much lower than the top teams. I think Norwich second bottom on $1 million a year. Nick Harris says, in the 20-team Premier League era, the lowest wage payers have never finished higher than 10th, have got relegated more often than not, 15 out of 24 seasons, on average finished 17th, Philippe. I mean, yeah, what Chris Wilder is doing is extraordinary.
It is admirable. I would say that what they're doing is almost like a mini Liverpool, as in they're constantly being asked questions. They sometimes find themselves in the rope. They always find the answer. And we've seen that so many times. I mean, I mean, the draw at the Emirates when they were under the cosh for quite a while, they still managed to find the means to get back into the game, equalise, and perhaps actually deserved a win there. Again, this weekend against Bournemouth, bit difficult start to the game, but they found the resources. And what is remarkable, I mean, Lars is commenting on the players he's got at his disposal. I mean, famously, he's got players who were with him when they were still in League One, and important players too. But that doesn't prevent them from playing a kind of football that you wouldn't associate at all with a team that is made of so-called journeymen and people who are very good footballers, but certainly not top level. I mean, and it's tactical, it's mental, but they've scored actually some of the best goals I've seen this season. Actually, the Lundstrom goal is an absolute thing of beauty in terms of the way it's constructed. It's the intelligence, tactical intelligence of everybody. It's just admirable. My only caveat will be that when people say, oh, it's not money, it so happens that CIES, which is the Observatory of Football, published this morning a study on the net transfer spend of clubs throughout Europe over the last two windows. And Sheffield United isn't there. And Sheffield United, in terms of transfer spend, have spent more money than Bayern Munich and Bayer Leverkusen. So we should always have relativized things and think it's the context of the Premier League as well, which is a good thing, by the way.
Bizarrely, though, Barry, this is only the second time this season Sheffield United have won consecutive games. I feel it's about the time in the pod where you say this is because the league isn't very good.
There are a lot of pretty mediocre teams in the league, and a lot of the teams that you'd expect to be performing better aren't. You know, Manchester United, Chelsea being a case in point, Arsenal. But Sheffield United seem to have a resilience that those teams don't have. And I think it's 10 different occasions they've rescued points from losing positions. And that sort of says a lot about their character, I suppose.
Hmm. And you mentioned the sort of mini Liverpool thing. Hmm. Jonathan and I were saying before the show, it's about systems, right? You look at Liverpool and Sheffield United, then it's the system that is as important as the players, I guess. And I was wondering, is it just sometimes you just hit a wave where every single person in the building is pushing in the same direction? And that's happening with Liverpool and Sheffield United, and it just generally doesn't happen because football is odd.
Yeah, for sure, and it just sounds so basic, but you watch them play and you can see every player on the pitch knows what he's supposed to do in every phase of the play, and that's just, it sounds enormously basic, but you watch a lot of football where players clearly don't know what they're meant to be doing, and it comes down to coaching. And I think there's a big help in the fact that a lot of these guys have been together for a while.
Absolutely.
I think this is easy to underestimate. We are obviously a little bit obsessed with transfers and moves and stuff because it's exciting, but there's huge value, I think, in a team being able to keep a core group of players together so they know each other, they know exactly where each other's moves come and this sort of thing.
Although, interestingly, we've used Bournemouth as that example, you know, of a team that are stuck together, of a manager who's taken players who weren't necessarily Premier League players and got them to this level, and now they've sort of hit their buffer.
Yes. Well, two things. First of all, I would say that the a contrario proof would be that the new players who've come to Sheffield United are finding it difficult to get playing time. So it shows that it's about the system rather than about the player. Well, it's about both, but the system is very important. And the second thing I would say that Sheffield United's system is in a way far more unique than Bournemouth's system, which is nothing. I mean, it's a very, you know, nobody will say that Bournemouth is a kind of simplistic team. It's not the case at all. But the Sheffield United model is quite unique, and it's not by chance that everybody in Europe has been talking about Sheffield United, not just because of the results, you know, a la Leicester or something like that, but because of the way they play, which is quite unique. Mm. And honestly, you know, you cannot find any other team which is set up the way they are, you know. And
anywhere in football?
I would say yes. I remember the first time I watched them in the Premier League, and I thought, I don't quite understand immediately how they are set up. And then it's only after a while you realise there's all this movement which is happening with their wing backs, their centre backs, and everything. You think, well, centre back in the penalty box, that's very unusual. And then you realise it's part of a philosophy that they've developed and that they've brought to a degree of sophistication, which is quite remarkable. And again, speaks volumes, not just for Chris Wilder, but also for his whole team.
But I mean, I think it's fair to say, Max, that at some point Sheffield United will also hit their buffer. Yeah. They're not going to be challenging for Champions League places on a regular basis. you would expect. Bournemouth were overperforming, and Sheffield United probably are now as well. And at some point they will, you know, drop down the table. Whether that happens to be next season or this remains to be seen.
Everton 3, Crystal Palace 1. Charlie says, how have Everton been so bad but are now winning the Everton Cup? They're on a great run of form here. Just one defeat in their last 11 at Manchester City. They've beaten Palace, Watford, Brighton, Newcastle, Burnley and Chelsea in that run. Since Ancelotti took over, 5 wins, 2 draws, 1 defeat. They're 7th. The only team who've got more points than them since Ancelotti took over is Liverpool. We're talking about systems, Lars. He seems to... I don't know if Duncan Ferguson did it first, but they're playing 4-4-2, and I've certainly been under the assumption that 4-4-2 was dead as a formation.
It's worth talking about that, actually, because they certainly set up in a way that I think a lot of conventional tactical thinking would say that that's not something you can really do in the Premiership, playing 4-4-2 with, like, I think it was Schneiderlin and Gylfi Sigurdsson in central midfield, and sort of Walcott and Bernard on the flanks. I mean... conventional thinking would be that you're going to get slaughtered if you do that, but if you watch them play, they're surprisingly disciplined. And I use surprisingly because you look at Theo Walcott and Bernard and you don't think of those as guys who would be natural fits for a sort of 4-4-2 wingers, because you have to tuck in and do a lot of work off the ball, but they are doing it, seems to me, certainly, and good defensive structure off the ball. And there are upsides to playing this way, and one of them is that you get a proper front two, you get a striker pairing, and certainly Calvert-Lewin seems to really thrive in this sort of a system. And again, with formations, it's so much about, it's not just the combination of numbers, it's about the work you put in the training ground and the structure you manage to set the team up in and the discipline with which the players will keep to that.
And also perhaps the fact, I mean, Richarlison is, I think, by far their best player. But he's not a centre forward and he's not a winger, but he's somebody who plays very well with a focal point playing with him. So it makes complete sense. And what is also interesting is that Ancelotti has never been thought of as a great tactician. Sounds crazy to say that for somebody who's won the Champions League and leagues and cups and everything. He's more seen as somebody who is very adept at getting the absolute maximum from generally very talented groups of players. And he's not just that. He's obviously the kind of he covers all areas of his job, and as I think surprised many people, and I have to say myself included, I wasn't convinced at all it would work, and it has worked.
So there's no Ancelotti ball. That's not a thing.
No, not really. If you compare his various teams, you know, various times, if you compare his Milan with his PSG, with his Real, these are not teams that you could say, oh, it's the same manager, they're playing the same system. No, not at all.
But the intriguing thing is this is kind of him going back to basics in a way, because he came up, as a player, he played under Sacchi, he was very inspired by Arrigo Sacchi and his sort of 4-4-2 zonal pressing type of thing. And he was very dogmatic about that, to the point where at Parma, he sort of couldn't find a place for Gianfranco Zola, because he's obviously a sort of floaty number 10 who wants to do his own thing. So he was kind of sent off on his way, and he admits in his biography that that was a huge mistake, and he realised later on that he was a bit of an idiot for not sort of adapting.
Who was he playing? I mean, would he at his peak, would he take Zola?
He had a really good team, that wasn't the point. It was just in this sort of 4-4-2, quite rigid, there was no room for Zola. And he sort of then went really far the other way, except Milan, of course, he had all these number 10s, like Berlusconi kept insisting on signing playmakers, and like, oh, here you go, Carletto, figure out a way to get these guys into the team. So hence you had like the Christmas tree with like with Kaká and Rui Costa and all this sort of thing, and Seedorf was there, and he had to make all these guys work in the same, so he then became very, very flexible. But we're back to now, he played 4-4-2 at Napoli quite a lot, which was something a lot of people thought was a bit weird and maybe it didn't fit those players, but it seems to be very successful so far at Everton.
Didn't Kaká get nutmegged in Hackney this weekend?
Yes, he was doing some sort of promotion, right. So he played 5-a-side with Hackney Wick.
Right.
And I think he scored 2 goals, one of them an absolute belter, a couple of assists, and got nutmegged by a rival player who was delighted with himself,
who now has an anecdote to rival the greatest of great anecdotes, doesn't he? Some people, Barry, saying Calvert-Lewin for England. He could do that job. I mean, I don't think opposition defences would be fearful. However, he could bring in all the other great players around him into play if Kane wasn't fit.
Yeah, he's turned into a better player at quite a young age, 22, than I thought he would. I can't see him starting for England. I see him possibly as a squad player with a very peripheral role. But certainly in years to come. Just one other thing about Everton, I've read Ancelotti's book as well, and he just comes across as a very genial, chilled out, relaxed bloke. And I'd imagine playing for him is quite a pleasure when contrasted with the regime of Marco Silva, who seems not particularly genial and chilled out, you know. So I think just he's changed the mood at Everton.
I think that's interesting.
And they haven't actually had to do that much to zoom up the table, because other teams are not playing particularly well.
It's interesting, isn't it? Whenever you hear about a relaxed manager and the players can do what they want, they say, what we need is someone to do double sessions and ban ketchup and tell us exactly when we're going to eat. And then when they get a manager who does double sessions and bans ketchup and tells them when to eat, they want someone just relaxed to say, just do what you want, guys. I mean, I suppose what's hard is to keep reinventing
that
yourself.
That can go wrong as well, of course. I mean, that's something that he's been accused of a few times in his career, Ancelotti, of just letting things drift a little bit.
James.
But right now, it doesn't matter that much, I think.
Sure. James says, can any of you start up front for Crystal Palace next game? Christian Benteke, first goal for Palace since the 21st of April 2019. The last time he scored before that was the 29th of April 2018. So his scoring rate is improving.
And it still looks as if his next slump has just begun, though.
Do you think he'll be the top scorer at the Euros, Barry?
No.
Pickford should have saved it. However, afterwards, Jordan Pickford, he had a slight go at pundits, and he picked out Gary Neville.
Quite a strong go at pundits.
He did, didn't he?
And the media.
And said, everyone hates you when you're England keeper. Everyone wants you to fail. Does he have a point, or does he not have a point?
I don't think he has a point. I mean, it's like that time when Phil Neville was appointed Lionesses manager and said, I know everyone wants me to fail. And everyone sort of went, no, we don't. You know, at best, we're indifferent to how you get on. And this seems like kind of the same weird siege mentality. I don't want Jordan Pickford to fail. If I was an England fan, I'd have concerns about his form. I don't think he's played particularly well this season. I think he's going to be in the England team, despite the fact that there's at least two keepers who are better than him, who won't be in it. And I have a concern he might cost England at the Euros. I'll add my usual caveat that Pickford made his name in a struggling Sunderland team when he was letting in three or four goals a game. And for any player to come through an experience like that and be England number one is mightily impressive. But I worry about his form at the moment. And he said also in that little rant that, you know, the criticism doesn't bother him. But it clearly does. And that is also a concern.
You'd have to remember that it's probably also some people closed to Pickford who are telling him, did you hear what so-and-so said about you? Did you see what so-and-so wrote about you? And also, I think he must be feeling that, given the performances of Henderson with Sheffield United, who's been absolutely tremendous all through the season, is thinking, wow, I might have a genuine competitor here. Maybe my status as number one could be, well, not in danger, but certainly we would expect Henderson, for example, to be used in the friendlies by Gary Southgate.
But we want competition for places, right? Absolutely. Anyway, look, Palace, on the other hand, on a terrible run, just one win in their last 11, which was against West Ham, so it doesn't really count. Six draws and four defeats. They're 14th, 30 points. Everyone says, Lars, oh, they'll be fine. Roy is a wily old fox, but will they?
I think they will probably be fine. I think there are
I think there are
three worse teams than them in this division. But no, of course you're a little bit worried about that form, and I don't know. They seem like they don't have that many good players, Max. I mean, it's a pretty sort of obvious thing to say, but if you go through the squad, like, they're very, very reliant on Zaha to do something. And apart from that, it's not a whole lot that, like, excites you. And that I guess that is the Roy Hodgson way. He assembles good soldiers who will keep the shape and will do what they're told on the pitch and this sort of thing. But they could maybe use
But it's funny because you hear the argument, oh, they've got their squad is actually quite good. I've heard that many a time.
Well, I would disagree with whoever made that.
But the only thing Zaha did on Saturday was give away the ball in the build-up to the first goal. He's been poor. He'd probably leave in the summer. They were just very pedestrian and clearly second best.
Yeah, and that Benteke goal, Palace's first since the Fernandinho own goal, which earned them a point at Man City. Just one goal in 4.5 hours. What fun being a Palace fan. And they only had two shots on target all game, both from Benteke, which was a good save from Pickford,
Yeah, if only there was recently some sort of period of time, perhaps a window in which you could do something.
Cenk Tosun.
Add some play. Yeah, yeah. Which is weird. Like, Cenk Tosun is a guy who scored a decent number of goals in Turkey, then went to England and didn't score a lot of goals. Like, I can think of another player who hasn't scored a lot of goals in England, but who's scoring a decent number of goals in Turkey. Already a Crystal Palace player, like Alexander Sørloth. We just get him back. He scored a bunch of goals in Turkey.
A fun Twitter thread from the the battle of the statisticians. This is from Simon Hart saying, "Stat of the weekend from Bill Edgar of the Times: Bernard and Richarlison, the first pair of Brazilians to score in a competitive match at Goodison since Pele and Garrincha in '66." Phil McNulty Phil McNulty from the BBC mentioned Richard Jolly saying, "Crisis talks at Richard Jolly Towers this morning to discover how he missed this one." To which Richard Jolly responded with, "Bernard is, I think, the only footballer who is the same height as Jennifer Aniston to score a Premier League goal at Goodison Park." That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll finish off the Premier League weekend with Brighton's draw with Watford.
Today in Focus is the daily news podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anoushka Astana, every weekday as I bring you stories from across the UK and around the world. We'll take you to the front line of the climate emergency.
The smoke smells like everything is on fire.
Behind the scenes in Westminster.
We're in the sort of political Wild West.
And we'll cover the latest trends in technology and popular culture.
TikTok, TikTok, buzz, buzz, buzz.
Go on, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly. Some live shows. Now, the four of us are doing Glasgow University Debating Chambers, but there are still a few tickets remaining, gentlemen, because we are not as big a pull as William Shatner.
Yeah.
So will you, Lars, dress as Dr. Spock?
Nope.
Mr. Spock.
Is it Mr. Spock?
Yes, he's not a GP.
Is he not, or a physician
or
any
a physician
time?
Of any kind. Okay. He's never done a PhD.
Okay.
I suppose, being the Frenchman, I should be Picard.
You can be. Will you be Picard? Who do you want to be? You can be Scotty, Lars.
Fine.
Okay.
Oh, I think, giving the accent implications and that we're doing it in Glasgow, I think that's a terrible idea. I'm going to offend so many people.
I don't know any other characters.
Well, I've got to be Scotty, don't I? He's an Irish man. Okay. Call him Meany.
Okay. So then who's Lars going to be?
Spock. Be Worf.
Oh, who's Worf? Is that the one with the funny head?
Yeah.
Okay, that works.
Sounds about right.
Anyway, we'll all dress up as Star Trek characters if you buy the rest of the tickets. We've sold out in Edinburgh on the 10th. 23rd of March, we're at Earth in Hackney, lineup TBC. 9th of April, back in Leeds. Same goes for that one, but there'll be stellar lineups, that's for sure. Of course, we're blinging. We are not blinging anyone up in Leeds, but we are bringing Flo Lloyd Hughes in some stocks for you to throw fruit at. That is unconfirmed. Brighton 1, Watford 1. Now, not the own goal of the weekend, Barry, from Adrian Mariapa, but it was for a while. It was a great finish.
It was a great finish, and totally unnecessary. I guess he thought Glenn Murray was on, you know, lurking behind him, ready to pounce, but Glenn Murray wasn't anywhere near him.
Did he forget Glenn Murray was 37 or something?
Glenn Murray was a good 5 or 6 yards away. So, but it was quite emphatic finish. Mm. And I wonder would Christian Benteke have sliced it wide? don't know.
Nigel Pearson said it's a very difficult ball to defend. I mean, arguably that wasn't the way to defend it, but does Pearson have a point, Lars? It is tricky. It's coming so quickly.
And he is haunted by the spectre of Murray. You know, Murray had got into his head and think he'll be there. Ooh, but he wasn't. It's a disappointing result for both teams, really. I mean, it's one of those where both would have felt this was a chance to get 3 points. And I think this is going to sound a little bit pompous. I think it would be really good for English football if Graham Potter succeeded at Brighton. I think he's the kind of guy who English football really needs to do well, because English coaches do have a bad reputation around the world. Some of that is merited, some of it isn't. But I think there's a lot of ambitious, hardworking, progressive thinking coaches in this country. They just tend to not get the big jobs because they're not ex-players with mates in the media and all this sort of stuff. Graham Potter is a guy who's, he's an educated guy and a guy who wanted to be a coach enough to go and work in the Swedish lower divisions and make his name that way. And it's great that Brighton have taken a punt on him, and he's trying to do something really really difficult in turning quite what was quite a reactive team under Chris Hughton into a more sort of ball-playing unit whilst also trying to not get relegated. There's so many different ways in which that can go wrong, and it started better than I thought it would. Currently, it does look like it is going a bit wrong, and it worries me because I think it would be really bad if it had had a bad outcome.
Decore's goal was a lovely finish, wasn't it? It was similar to Richarlison's, actually, in just that the speed of the touch from the left foot to the right foot, and his finish was great. Do you want to give him some love?
I've already given a lot of love to Abdoulaye Doucouré.
Have you given enough, or do you want to give more?
I can give some more love to Abdoulaye Doucouré. I'm just delighted to see him play in a position that suits his qualities better. The other thing about that goal, of course, is the fact he takes it on the half volley, which makes it even sweeter and makes that the ball stays hit absolutely wonderfully, as you like it, I know.
I love it. But yeah, a ball stays ball, yeah. Delafeo on Schelotto, Barry. Penalty?
I thought so. Yeah.
Does everyone agree with Barry? I still don't know what the right call is, because you could argue that Schelotto kicks Delafeo's thigh. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. From one angle, it looked like a penalty, and from the other one, it didn't. Really difficult.
I've seen him given, Lars.
Yeah, but I'm not going to like man the barricades over it not being given.
The fact that there is contact doesn't mean there is a foul. That's which is one thing which needs to be
reminded. I'm aware of that.
Reminded.
I still thought it was a foul, but you know, I'll do.
You were not going to man the barricade. We're not going to have
we won't fall out over it.
There are very few things that can feasibly happen between Brighton and Watford that would trigger a manning of the barricades.
I mean, unlikely. Watford are dropping a hell of a lot of points from winning positions, and there's four now in the last two games, and they sat back needlessly in that game, I thought, and invited Brighton to come back at them and
Potter made some changes, didn't he? That helped, you know, Jahan Bash, Morpai coming on, sort of brought them back into the game. But they had to do that because I still didn't see Brighton scoring.
No, well, they're quite pretty to watch, but fairly ineffective. You know, they move the ball very slowly, I think, and they don't get it up forward quick enough.
Between them, Duffy, Duncan, Murray won the ball in the air 25 times, six more than the entire Watford squad. So is the idea that Potter is trying to play football, is he changing a bit? Or is that just because Watford lump it, so Duffy and Duncan got ahead it?
I think the latter. Mm-hmm. And for all the fact that he's a very progressive coach, especially in the way he manages his team, I don't think he's necessarily a revolutionary coach, which is one of the things that I really like about Brighton and enjoy watching them, is that they play rather quite simple football, really, which is not that easy to do at all. And they don't overcomplicate things. There are no tactical setups which are incredibly sophisticated. It's just getting them to click as a unit, which they do very well. But as Barry was saying, unfortunately, they don't really have the firepower up front. I mean, with a proper centre forward or two, they would score an awful lot more goals than they do at the moment. For sure.
Just a couple of other stories from around the Premier League. Dele Alli has apologised for a video posted on his Snapchat account where he appeared to mock an Asian man and joke about the coronavirus. He said, "I'd like to apologise for the video I posted on Snapchat yesterday. It wasn't funny. I realised that immediately and took it down. I've let myself down. And the club." One of the games that was meant to be on TV but wasn't yesterday was Manchester City West Ham. It was postponed because of Storm Kira. It claimed matches in England, Germany, Belgium and the Netherlands, as well as the entire weekend of women's football. That didn't stop Jacqueline Gold, daughter of David, tweeting, "Got a good feeling about the game today. Let's do this."
I think that game worked out a lot better for West Ham than it might otherwise have done. I think that.
What is extraordinary, what is surprising, I learned today, thanks to Matt Slater, actually, there is no protocol in place in the Premier League when you've got weather conditions of that kind. It's not as if you were applying rules which were valid all through the country, all through the competition.
How do you mean?
It's entirely up to the people in charge of safety at each club, each ground, to decide whether, obviously in cooperation with the local authorities, to decide whether it's safe or not to proceed. But there is no list of boxes that you take to say, well, no, this is too dangerous, this doesn't matter, and so forth. No, it's entirely left to the judgment of the people in place, which explains why one game was cancelled in the Premier League, that is, and the other was not. And then all the games in the WSL and also the lower divisions were cancelled.
City now have a ludicrous fixture backlog. They've got the Champions League, they've got the FA Cup, they've got the Carabao Cup final. They've got to find a place to put this West Ham game in. They may have three games in a week at some point. I mean, you imagine they are going to have to prioritise everything but the Premier League. They've got Leicester, the game they come back, and then they've got Real Madrid. And if you're Pep, you've got to rest their players. Right?
I think they had two midweek spots, which are both taken now. And of course, it also depends what happens in the FA Cup. Mm-hmm. And also, UEFA don't see it with a very kind eye if teams decide or a competition decides to stage games during a Champions League week. So that's actually a real headache. And you look at the schedule of the calendar, you wonder, when on earth are they going to play that game?
Much more importantly, Matt says, instead of postponing yesterday's City game because of the storm, wouldn't it have been better to make them play the game, but with a 99p flyaway ball from the corner shop? A shoot size 5, he says. I dare say Sky would never have known such viewing figures.
I watched quite a lot of the Millwall-West Brom game yesterday, which was very entertaining, due in no small part to the horrific conditions. At one stage, one of the teams was trying to take a corner and the ball just would not stay in the quadrant. So we almost had that sort of rugby-style situation where one player was going to have to hold the ball down while someone else kicked it into the penalty
area. That is nightmares from secondary school, of having to lie face down in the freezing mud.
One of England's players, Ellis Genge, had to do it at Murrayfield on Saturday, and he made an absolute dog's breakfast of it. So you're supposed to hold it with one finger, just with one finger resting in a ball, and then not look so that you don't know when it's been kicked, and you don't therefore remove your finger. But he had his whole hand resting on the ball, and then he took it away at the last second just before Owen Farrell kicked it.
You mentioned the weather. Before the game, you've got to feel for the three people or two people trying to keep the Sky Bet. What is that? What is that? A banner? What do you call it?
A banner, yes.
The banner, you know, just for
tarpaulin.
The tarpaulin for the drone shot. And they couldn't keep that. How did West Brom play despite the conditions?
They played well. They coped better with the conditions. It's a game that could have gone either way. I was very impressed with West Brom, but I was equally impressed. Not equally impressed, but I liked what I saw in Millwall as well. And West Brom won 2-0. Wasn't a comfortable 2-0, but two decent teams. Like, you know, Millwall are sort of punching above their weight in the Championship, and West Brom are probably the best team in the Championship.
Yeah, no slight on Millwall. They do what they do well, and it's got well done for them being in the Championship. But, I mean, they did register a pass completion percentage of 63 here in this game, meaning that 4 out of every 10 passes went awry. That is a very high number.
I thought you were going to put percent on the end, and I thought, is that good or bad? I can't work out if that's good or bad.
63% of their passes hit a teammate.
Ah.
So 4 out of every 10 passes went awry.
You say hit the teammate and then
bounced into touch.
It was seriously windy, and the den is in quite an exposed area. It's like a...
Nothing worse than playing football in the wind. So West Brom have a 4-point advantage below them, though. I mean, it is incredibly tight. All played the same. Leeds 55, Fulham 55, Forest 54, Brentford 53. Leeds lost again away at Forest. They never really got going at all. Forest completely deserved this win without playing brilliantly. We've mentioned it, you know, it seems like such a cliche to just say, you know, the Leeds sort of combusting again, but it seems to be happening, Philly.
Well, that's the traditional, you know, way things go with Bielsa. It happened at Athletic, it happened with Marseille, it's happened with Leeds already, so it tends to be the case, yes. I suppose, you know, when the physical demands are such, there's a moment when the body just says, no, I can't carry on being at this kind of level. I think maybe you're a bit silly, because Leeds did have quite a few chances, actually, to get back into the game. And the second goal was, anyway, just a defensive shocking defensive mistake, but didn't change much in the end. But they were not totally out of it.
There was one push on the line, wasn't there, from the Forest keeper.
The remarkable double save. Yeah. My goodness, that was fantastic.
You're right. I mean, goals obviously dictate the narrative, but it's true. It's the same with Brentford, right, who beat Millwall with a late goal from Ollie Watkins, but at 2-2, and Middlesbrough had pegged it back twice. At 2-2, Middlesbrough had an absolutely glaring chance to win that game. Fulham only won 1-0. Mitrovic, I mean, that could be the difference. So a lot of people have talked about Bamford getting lots of big chances in crucial games and not taking those chances, and you think about Mitrovic and certainly his ability at that level to win you games, and he got Fulham's winner
We were talking about Brighton, imagine a Mitrovic at Brighton, for example.
Let's make it happen.
Pontus Janssen, formerly of Leeds, now at Brentford, did a good interview with Ben Fisher for The Guardian, and he said that while at Leeds last season, while he learnt an awful lot from Marcelo Bielsa, he said he does have a dark or a bad side, but, you know, so does everyone. But he said that it was around March, April that he began to feel incredibly drained. Mm-hmm. And he said he was particularly mentally drained, although he did add the caveat that he'd also had a baby for the first time, he and his partner. So that might have been a contributory factor. But yeah, he recalled it as being around March, April that the season really started to take its toll. Yeah.
Do you think Bielsa would... I mean, Bielsa seems such a legend. But you'd think he'd learn, wouldn't you?
But I think the mental aspect of it. Of course, the physical, when you play that way, it tires you. But yeah, Janssen's saying the mental... I mean, Jonathan Wilson of this parish spoke to some former disciples of Bielsa. I think it was for his Argentina book, who also said this mental aspect of it is... And I guess he is an obsessive character, Bielsa. Like, it's hard for you to suddenly change who you are mid-season and be less on it.
He couldn't change it. I mean, that's what has made him successful, because he has been successful. And we've got to remember, Leeds don't necessarily have the squad, the most talented squad in the Championship.
No.
They don't.
But if you're put on this pedestal, and I don't know if it's just because it's put on by Jonathan Wilson, he's put on a pedestal by lots of people. He's old enough now to realise how long a football season is, right?
But I think he's put on a pedestal as an important man, theoretically, in terms of the ideas he's brought to the game and the way other people have taken those on and redeveloped it. I don't think anyone's ever made the case that Bielsa is the most sort of effective trophy hunter, yeah, managerial-wise.
Okay,
but
okay.
He gave, you know, Pep Guardiola a lot of his ideas for how to play the game. He gave Pochettino a lot of his ideas for how to play the game. I mean, that's more like how you see his influence.
Fine. Bristol City lost to Birmingham City on Friday night. Disappointingly high camera angle at Ashton Gate makes it look like sort of sensible soccer. It was sort of very hard to... Very disappointing. I was upset about it anyway. I remember when there was a very high angle at Anfield, I was still at Sky and I could talk to them. I could try. I had influence there to say, you've got to change this. I no longer have that huge influence on football.
Talking about camera angles, mm-hmm. I read something just a couple of days ago about a development in filming games which actually scared me, which is this new technology which is going to enable to have shots which are kind of subjective camera shots, as in, for example, a player lines up to kick a free kick. You'll be able to show what it feels like, what it looks like from the perspective of the guy who's taking the
point of view shot.
Point of view shot, like subjective camera. Oh. And is going to be tried out, I think, in Ligue 1, apparently in Paris. What a surprise. And it involves 38 cameras put across the stadium. And basically, it becomes more and more, televised football becomes more and more like video game football.
Does Mbappe have to wear a video camcorder?
To be honest, no, it doesn't have a GoPro. I don't know exactly how it's working, but it will give you, the viewer, the possibility to enjoy football from a 360 degrees.
Could be good. I don't know. I quite like the penalties when they're down at that angle. Anyway, that Bristol City's defeat means they drop out of the playoffs at Preston's expense. That's the very French noises you made there, Philippe. Preston won at Wigan. Big win at the bottom for Stoke. They beat Charlton, move above them, putting a 5-point gap between themselves and the relegation zone. In League One, wins for 6 of the top 7 means there's no change at the top. Rotherham top, Wigan second, Peterborough disappointingly in third. Ipswich, the only team in the top 7 who failed to win. They lost to Sunderland, who jump above them, back into the playoffs. A 1-point gap from second to third, and from third to fourth, and from fourth to fifth, which is nice. Blackpool, the only bottom half team to get a win. They beat Southend 2-1. Southend, obviously, adrift. Not as adrift as Bolton, but adrift from Tranmere, who are in 21st. Their horrendous run continues. Just 2 points in their last 9 games. The table just says LLLLLLLLL. 6 points adrift they are. Meanwhile, the campaign to get AFC Wimbledon back to Plough Lane, Philippe, is doing well, isn't it?
Absolutely. They got to find the money rather quickly. Well, they got to find quite a lot of money quite quickly. And their initiative, which is basically to ask fans to put money to buy bonds, basically, they've hit the £3 million this weekend, which is quite extraordinary. Their aim is to hit £5 million. For I think a total cost of £11 million to finish off the construction or the reconstruction of Plough Lane. So absolutely magnificent effort.
In League Two, 3 of the top 7 lost. Exeter, the big beneficiaries, as they put 3 points between themselves in third and the playoffs. Plymouth in fourth have a game in hand. A huge win for Cambridge United, 1-0 at Newport. 2 wins in 2 since the end of the Calderwood Revolution.
Have you got a manager yet?
Now, the manager that we suspect we're going to get is a guy who was managing the Brighton under-23s. And no one had heard of him, but apparently he has a very good reputation. One of these sort of young, up-and-coming coaches, Simon Rusk is his name. But that is all the information I have so far. Don't know if it's confirmed yet, but I haven't ruled myself out of the running. Fitbar Corner, Barry.
Yeah, it was a Scottish Cup weekend, and the wind was wreaking havoc in Scotland, as anyone who saw any of the Scottish Fitbar, or indeed the England-Scotland rugby match will know. And that, sort of, I thought maybe, oh, we might have a few upsets, but we didn't. Celtic were too good for Clyde, beat them 3-0 away, and have now won 33 consecutive domestic cup matches. And yeah, they're going for the quadruple treble is still on. Rangers beat Hamilton 4-1, and Alfredo Morales was on the score sheet there. He's back from suspension. And the BSC Glasgow from the Lowland Leagues, they were entertaining Hibs. People thought, maybe. But Hibs were too good for them, beat them 4-1. So the draw for the last eight, it's Hearts v Rangers, Hibs v Inverness, who are the only team outside of the Premiership in the last eight. St Mirren or Motherwell v Aberdeen or Kilmarnock, and Celtic are away to St Johnstone.
Thank you so much, Barry, and that'll do for part two. Part three will begin in Spain with Sid Lowe. Hello, welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. We begin, as we always do, with Sid Lowe in Spain. Hey, Sid.
Hello, how are you, Max?
I'm very good. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. Not bad at all, thanks.
I'm pleased about that. Wins for all the big three then. Barcelona had to work the hardest for it. 3-2 at Betis, coming from behind twice. And two goal scorers got sent off. Sounds great.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, actually. It was really, really open. The game got very, very stretched in the last kind of half an hour or so. And there were a lot of chances. And both teams, in the end, I think, felt pretty annoyed with the referee, pretty annoyed with how it had gone. But it had been very enjoyable to watch.
And like really important for Setien, right?
Massive, yeah. I mean, he said himself, and obviously this goes well beyond him, but you know, the importance of winning away, because their away form has been really, really awful this season. The significance of it, because they come off the back of having been knocked out of the Copa del Rey, that they needed to win come what may. And also because Setien, of course, keeps talking about styles and about identities and about being on a path, which of course he's quite entitled to say. You know, he's trying to change things and shift the way that they play, and trying to find ways of opening teams up who are defensive, which wasn't the case for Betis, because they went and pressed very high. So there's lots of space in the middle of the pitch. The pitch got very, very stretched. But he said afterwards that he was really pleased and he thinks they're going in the right direction. But the thing that he's most interested in, Setien, which is control, they still haven't really got it, Barcelona. They still don't. There's always moments in every game where they look vulnerable still.
Presumably, every time Messi got the ball, would the camera cut to Abidal in the crowd and then cut back and just see if they were smiling at each other?
No, we didn't get much at Abidal. The only real, I'm trying to think, you know, over the last few days, the one moment I think we've seen Abidal was the day after it all kicked off, and he went to Bilbao separate from the rest of the team because he was travelling with Samuel Umtiti, who'd had a court case in the morning, which is great preparation for a cup tie, I'm sure you'll agree. And they drove to the hotel together, and so there was footage of them being led into the hotel, and of course he was followed through into the hotel. But since then, I mean, I may be wrong on this, but I can't picture a moment where we've seen him yet.
Why was Samuel Umtiti up before the beak, Sid?
He was accused by, I'm assuming it was a rented flat, he was accused by the owners of a flat of causing nearly €200,000 worth of damage. Like the floor was a little bit torn, some of the taps didn't work, I think there was some damage in the swimming pool. These are all the allegations anyway. To which he said, I've not had any parties in this flat. But, I mean, you can still smash a flat up without having parties, I suppose.
It's very heavy-legged, Umtiti, yeah. Isn't he? Good performance from Nabil Fekir. Then got sent off. Some talking about him making a move to a bigger club after this season. We've heard that before, haven't we?
Well, of course, he was on the verge, wasn't he, of going to Liverpool, but there were problems with his knee, which is why he didn't. He's been very, very exciting to watch this season at Betis. A little bit hot-headed. He got himself sent off. I must admit, though, at the risk of sounding like I'm tolerant of players having a go at referees, there's a bit of me that thinks quite often when referees get out the second yellow card. So what happened yesterday is Nabil Fekir makes a foul. It's a bad one. It's a yellow card. he turns away and he says something. It doesn't seem to be especially awful, although I honestly don't know. And he does a kind of a little gesture of just sort of flicking his hand over his shoulder. Referee then immediately shows him the yellow card again. Now, here's my, albeit very sort of based on nothing in particular, theory. If the referee didn't still have the yellow card in his hand, I don't think he'd have given him the second yellow card. I think it was a reaction of an angry man, yeah, not the reaction of a man implying, you know, applying the rules. And I don't know about you, but I sometimes think that yellow cards are given out for so many things that are so petty and don't really matter, and not given out for the things that actually do matter, which is when people try and break people's legs in half.
I agree with you entirely, Sid. Barry, someone called Hamish got in touch to say, could Barry say Nabil Fekir?
Nabil Fekir.
Thank you very much. you know what you're here for, Barry.
You cheeky Fekir.
Real Madrid still 3 points clear at the top. Routine win for them.
Well, sort of. Not quite as routine as it looked. They went 1-0 down. They were 2-1 up. And as you say, although they scored four, two of those, I think, are in the last 6 minutes or so. But it's the kind of routine win, if we are going to call it routine, that's important. There's a little bit of mythology built up around certain stadiums in Spain. But there's always this idea that you go away to Osasuna, you go to Pamplona and you win. And to use that old cliche, that's the kind of grounds where you win league titles. You know, it's tough, it's hostile. They're a very aggressive team, a very direct team, although admittedly not as good since Jimmy Avila got his injury, what was it, 3 weeks ago now. But yeah, an important win for Madrid. Not quite routine.
Getafe on their fourth win in a row. They're now third. What is going on there?
They are brilliant. I mean, they're absolutely brilliant. They beat Valencia at the weekend. They didn't just beat Valencia, they took Valencia to pieces. And if you get the chance, have a look at the post-match interview from Gabriel Paulista, of course, the one who was at Arsenal. And he's asked the first question and his eyes just glaze over, and it takes him, or I might be exaggerating, but it feels like 6 or 7 seconds to respond. Like he doesn't know what to say. And he says, "I'd like to talk, but I can't." And then there's this pause again and he said, "It was shit. All of it was shit. Everything was shit." And of course, that's true with Valencia. But everything that Getafe did was brilliant. And they are a team that have this reputation for being dirty, for being aggressive and all the rest of it. But they played fantastically well as well. It's the best I think I've ever seen them play. And they are third in the table. And to put this into context of how crazy this is, and I've been looking at the stats today because I'm writing about them. So their starting 11 at the weekend cost €16.2 million, right? Which is half of Valencia's centre-forward. And also, in case you're thinking, yeah, but he's the expensive one, half of the other centre-forward as well. And this is, you know, this is a club that's got a budget a 16th the size of Real Madrid and Barcelona. I worked it out. They have more experience, 3 times more experiences of relegation amongst their first team squad than they have of ever winning anything. I mean, they're just amazing.
Can they stick there?
Yes. They're good enough. I mean, I'm not saying they will. That's, yes, sounding very determined and positive. Yes, because they can. Obviously, they might not last year. Bear in mind that last year, they were in a Champions League place for 22 minutes on the final day of the season. They lost it to Valencia, who've become this kind of rival of theirs, which is a slightly weird rivalry. And they were really unlucky not to get there last year. They're better placed to do it this year. It would still be a miracle. But right now, it's starting to feel like, yeah, this is the most normal thing in the world if they finish third or fourth.
Sid, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. And Philippe, congratulations to you. This is the first time that you've been on a pod and someone else has sworn before you. So well done.
Oh, that's true. Well, it was Gabriel, so it was a player, so it doesn't really matter.
Okay, fair enough. He was just quoting the player. You're absolutely right. Yes. From Spain to Italy. And also Barry swore in that piece as well, didn't he? So tremendous. From Spain to Italy now, Nicky Mandini's roundup, where Juve lost and there was a potentially significant Milan derby late Sunday night.
Oh yes, potentially significant, Max, and also just a little bit bonkers. As you alluded to there, Juventus lost to Hellas Verona on Saturday, and honestly, I could do 10 minutes just on that, because Verona, little newly promoted Verona, who have the lowest wage bill in all of Serie A, they played Milan, Lazio and Juventus in the space of a week. They drew the first two and then beat Juventus, but they could easily have won all three of those games. They got back in the game against Juventus, having gone a goal down. I think Baz especially might like this, with Fabio Borini grabbing the equaliser before Giampaolo Pazzini, who's all of 35 years young, scored the winner from the penalty spot. Verona are up to 6th. They haven't lost in 8 games, and they are doing just an incredible job under Ivan Juric. But I know you don't want me to talk about that. You want me to talk about the derby. Verona's win meant that Inter could pull level with Juventus at the top of Serie A, which they duly did. But only after going in 2-0 down at half-time, and deservedly so, frankly, after being totally outplayed by a team that was 19 points below them before kickoff. Zlatan Ibrahimovic was just brilliant. He set up the first Milan goal, he scored the second, and actually Milan hadn't lost a game yet since he returned, so it was looking pretty bleak for Inter at the break. But then Marcelo Brozovic scores this fantastic volley right at the start of the second half. They equalised 2 minutes later, and after that the game just totally flipped. Milan were on tilt, Inter became this live-action highlight reel with Stefan de Vrij scoring a header that barely even made sense, bent down to shin height and across his body. Christian Eriksen off the bench had a free kick that caught the inside of the bar and post but came back out. There could have easily been more goals ahead, but then, for more drama, Milan hit the post through Ibrahimovic in the 89th minute before Lukaku finally seals the deal in injury time off a cross from Victor Moses, of all people. Honestly, this was just such an enjoyable derby, right down to the extraordinary mobile phone choreography that Milan fans put on before kickoff. I won't say exactly what that said because they use a gently bad word, but you can find it online very easily, possibly even in my column this morning. It's the first time Inter have come from two down to win a derby since the 40s, so it's fair to say you don't see games like this very often. It also means that Inter are joint top. We haven't seen that since 2010 when they won the treble. Lazio are only a point behind them and Juventus, so three teams separated by 1 point. And Inter go to Lazio next weekend, so more to look forward to. As for Juve, there's some real anxiety though starting to creep in there, because they really don't look anything like this free-flowing team that was hoped for and perhaps sold to the fans when they hired Maurizio Sarri in the summer. This even though Ronaldo has now scored in 10 consecutive games. There was a report in La Repubblica, which is a big national newspaper not known for giving in too easily to gossip, but a report from them this morning that Juventus might even be considering letting go of Sarri and bringing back Max Allegri, who in classic Italian "we fired you but don't want to pay the severance" style is technically still under contract.
From Italy to Germany, welcome back to the pod, Archie Rintart. How are you, Archie?
Very well, Max.
Nice to speak to you. Yeah, game of the weekend. Bayer Leverkusen 4, Borussia Dortmund 3. 7 goals, both teams taking the lead, not once but twice, and Dortmund blowing a chance to go joint top. What a game.
Yeah, it was quite a ride, particularly because neither side had any real sustained spell of pressure. It was back and forth, quite a lot like ping pong, to be honest. And a fantastic goal by Emre Can on his debut as well. 30 yards out into the top corner. But this game just showed why Borussia Dortmund aren't going to win the Bundesliga title this season, because their defence is just not up to it, as it has not been under Lucien Favre even last season. Bit harsh, perhaps, given the margin which they lost out on the title. But it's just the fact that they are not learning these lessons. And I think there's a grimness that Dortmund fans go into the final 15 minutes of games with, knowing that they are shaky under pressure. And I saw it in sporting director Michel Thorc's eyes as he had to answer the same question yet again about what went wrong on Saturday. But this was very entertaining and it was a lot of fun. I mean, 7 goals, plus you have 3 disallowed goals as well. And you add to that that Leverkusen under Peter Bosch, like, it's hell or high water. And it is a lot of fun to watch. And Lars,
yeah,
Erling Haaland didn't score.
I was going to say the goal drought for Erling Haaland is a worry now, isn't it?
Yeah, no. What can you do? I do have a question for you, Archie. You were there, right? I mean, I was just watching this game. Like, Lucien Favre is sort of lauded as this great scholarly type, this coach, obsessive, who works on people's like foot position and where their hands are and all this sort of micromanagement of players. I know his record is really good, and if he's so good, why do Dortmund's defenders keep doing so many weird things? Like, every time you watch this, there's this bizarre stuff going on in defense. Can he not fix this?
I think that's the frustration as well. I mean, Peter Bosch made a tactical switch that I don't think Dortmund were quite able to keep up with or quite adjusted for when Moussa Diaby came off and Leon Bailey came on, and Leverkusen went to more of a back four. As you say, it doesn't really account for how these individual mistakes continue to happen. And also, you look at the shape of Dortmund on that third goal and how wonky it was. And it's really difficult to explain because, as you say, Favre does have this reputation. But I think the problem is that Favre has a problem that he created at Borussia Mönchengladbach for himself here, in that the long shadow of Jurgen Klopp is still very much hanging over Dortmund. He's not the sort of character in the media that can excite the fans. I think he frustrates in that sense, but I think his scholarly way is not going to bring Dortmund the title that they are really begging for right now. And okay, he can add all these nice touches, but ultimately, I'm not sure it's enough to bring you a title.
A big Sunday night game was first v second Bayern v Leipzig. You get good goalless draws. Was this a good goalless draw?
I think so. It also showed that if you're going to win the title, you're going to need to be able to defend. And that's what Leipzig and Bayern can do, and Dortmund and Leverkusen can't. So you had a really big chance in the second half for either side, for both sides. I mean, Leipzig had two in Marcel Sabitzer firing over the bar just after half time. Timo Werner being in front of goal, balls bouncing, but puts it wide when you would expect him to score, given that he scored 20 this season. And Leon Goretzka forced a really good save out of Peter Gulacsi in the Leipzig goal when he was through one-on-one. I think There was talk of why Leipzig set up so defensively in the first half with what was almost a back five. Julian Nagelsmann, the coach, was answering questions from Jens Lehmann on Sky's coverage after the game and saying that actually he'd seen the other way of playing against Bayern and he thought that this was going to work out best, and ultimately they'd come away with a clean sheet. So he was pretty happy, and I think that's the thing. Thomas Müller was saying after the game, the Bayern forward, that he felt that neither side really wanted to win it and was quite happy with a draw. And I think that given the fact there's just a point between them now, it kind of reflected that as well in the way the game played out. One thing to also add, there's been a lot of talk over here about, given Thomas Müller's good recent form, whether he might make a late run back into the Germany squad. Joachim Löw was conveniently at the Allianz Arena yesterday, was asked about that by Sky, said that the chances were relatively low. Then Müller had that put to him in his post-match interview. And Müller said, to be honest, European championships absolutely don't matter to me right now. All that matters is Bayern Munich. And then he gave a big kind of chest-thumping point to his Bayern Munich badge on his chest, which I think was also a little point to Joachim Löw, because Löw, of course, famously dropped Boateng, Hummels and Müller permanently from their international careers last year in a matter of minutes in Munich. So, yeah, that's one thing to watch. But Germany do have a lot of attacking talent as well.
Archie, there are reports in the papers over here today that Bayern might try to tempt Liverpool with a 75 million quid bid for Roberto Firmino in the summer. Could you see that being a possibility?
No, not really.
Fair enough.
Thanks, Archie. Now, Mönchengladbach versus Cologne got called off thanks to Storm Kira. Rescheduling it's causing a few headaches.
Yeah, because I don't know if you know about this, Max, but Carnival's quite a big thing over here.
Yes, you've sent photos, I'm sure, before.
Yeah, photos of all kinds of costumes as well, yeah. And Horst Held, the sporting director at Cologne, was yesterday after the game got called off, about 6 a.m. it was in the end, he was saying that we need to look about when we're going to replay the game because of the various activities that we have in February, which is him saying we don't want to play this because Carnival in a few weeks, which is encouraging to see. Also because Cologne come by on a big double-decker bus as if they've won a trophy, which it's been a long time that they have done something like that, but instead they're all throwing sweets off the top of the bus, which is good. I think I got hit by a Mars bar by something thrown by a player.
Priorities matter. Listen,
it really hurt. Let me tell you.
I'm sure it did. I mean, of all the chocolate bars, it's quite a heavy one, isn't it? You really want to get hit by
the bridge of the nose.
A Milky Way is better, or a
certainly Aero. Not a Yorkie or no, a Toblerone.
No, a Curly Whirly would be all right, wouldn't it? An Aero, you're right, Philippe. Speaking of Cologne, you have Lukas Podolski news, aren't you?
I do. Lukas Podolski nearly came back to Cologne. Oh. I mean, nearly is not really the word. There was an opening after his contract at Vissel Kobe in Japan ran out that Podolski wanted the move back to the club. Cologne didn't want that Podolski came back on the playing side, but they have agreed a deal, so it is reported over here, that his famous Döner kebab is going to be in the stadium from next season.
Tremendous.
So, yeah.
That's marvellous.
What
news
well, for the kebab franchise?
The whole pod are going to emigrate to Cologne for that one reason and one reason only. Nice to have you back, Archie. Cheers for coming on.
Thanks, Max.
Archie Wintz up there out in Lukas Podolski's kebab shop to France now. PSG, 12 points clear at the top. They beat Lyon 4-2. Jim says, is Fernando Marcel's own goal in the PSG-Lyon game the greatest you've ever seen?
I think it's a genuine candidate because usually you have the it's really good, it's really funny, you know, when it happens. But this one has got something else. It's the build-up.
The build-up's so good because it's almost like they're all attacking,
yes.
Right? Isn't it?
I know. It's as if they're combining to create the perfect opportunity for this magnificent own goal in the roof of a net. I mean, it's a real Exocet missile, isn't it?
But anyway, 7 of the top 8 won. The only winner out of the top 8 was Nîmes. Now 4 points clear of the automatic relegation after 3 wins on the bounce.
To mention the fact that Marseille has won again and that Marseille haven't lost a single game in Ligue 1 since they were defeated by PSG. And they're now clear in second place. And a magnificent goal by Dimitri Payet, by the way, who at the moment is playing in so well that people are thinking maybe he could earn a recall by Didier Deschamps for the Euro 2020, right. Which is, you know, not exactly what you would have said about a year ago from Dimitri Payet.
The Japanese Super Cup. Did anyone see this between Vissel Kobe and Yokohama F. Marinos in a penalty shootout? Missed 9 penalties in a row, including a miss by Thomas Vermaelen. After the first 4 penalties were scored, the next 9 were missed, and it was left to Hotaru Yamaguchi to seal victory for Vissel Kobe. Iniesta was running off in celebration with him. But just find it and watch as every single one is missed. That was great. And just before, to finish on this, I don't think I'd ever had this conversation with you before, Philippe. You have literally never driven a car.
That's correct. I've never driven a car.
You have never got behind the wheel of a car.
Nope.
But you can drive a tractor.
I can drive a tractor. I'm a country boy, me. So I drove the tractor on the family farm, but I never, ever drove a car.
Wilson can't drive either.
But he must have driven a car. Not being able to drive.
I'm not so sure he has.
Do you think to be a real football expert, you need to have focused so much on football that you can't drive? And the thing that's holding me and you back, Barry, is the fact that we can drive a car.
Well, I can't. I don't have a car. Oh. I had one. But
so you're ahead of me.
I got rid because I hardly ever used it.
Oh, Lars?
I can drive a car, so I'm really muddying the waters here now. I was briefly a sort of pizza delivery person in my youth, and I was, I think, one of the only people on staff who didn't crash the pizza car at any point, so I did all right.
But you did fall over on your Subway.
Well, I've regressed a little bit, I guess you can say.
Anyway.
I did drive like a truck in a warehouse for a bit as well. It's quite canny with a truck.
Fun. Right, that'll do for today. Philip, thank you.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.